Joyce tells me that she is so bad at doing intros, and I have therefore graciously offered to introduce myself. Hello, I'm David Friedman. I gather this is supposed to be something shorter than the talks that we've been having. And I thought I would try to talk briefly on two different topics. The first is, what do I think my book added to libertarian ideas? Why do I think it was a useful book? And the second is, what are the things I've learned since that I hope to add when I get around to doing a third edition? So on the first category, it seems to me that there are two important ways in which my book differs from at least most of what was going on at the time. And the first one is that it is explicitly consequentialist rather than moralist. That my view is not that there's no such thing as right and wrong. It seems to me clear there are certain things which to my moral intuition are bad. But I think that my foundations for those beliefs are not very strong. I don't have arguments which any reasonable, intelligent person ought to see as good reasons to agree with my moral beliefs. I think I do have arguments that any reasonable, intelligent person ought to see as reasons to agree with my consequentialist beliefs, my views of economics and of what consequences follow from what things. Good reasons to believe doesn't mean I can necessarily convince someone. Somebody might say, well, yes, indeed, that's a good argument for anarchy, but here are some other arguments that I think are good arguments against. I don't think the world is simple enough that one can sort of provide absolute rigorous knockdown arguments for one's views. But I think I can come closer to doing that with regard to my view that if you have certain institutions, certain consequences will follow, than with my view that certain consequences are right or wrong. And I'm reinforced in my sort of tactical decision to argue consequences rather than morality by the perception that people differ on morality less than they think they do. And what struck me a long time ago was that when you have sort of libertarian socialist style arguments, they can never agree on the facts. That you start out with some hypothetical situation you're trying to judge. Should the rich person have to feed the poor starving person kind of question? And it turns out that in the libertarian's implicit story, the rich person and the poor person arrived on the edge of an empty wilderness, and the rich person spent 20 years of hard work cutting down trees and planting crops and doing all those things while the poor guy wandered around, you know, eating acorns and such and being lazy. And then the poor guy said, look, I'm poor and hungry, feed me. On the other hand, in the socialist version of the story, the poor guy arrived in the wilderness and he worked very hard cutting down trees and clearing things. And then the rich guy somehow swindled him out of all of it. And now, and that sort of repeated experience suggests to me that the two sides have moral beliefs that, although not identical, are close enough to identical so that if the socialist really accepted the libertarian's factual assumptions, he'd be very uncomfortable with his conclusion, and vice versa if you reverse it. So that's part of my grounds for, in that book and in most of what I've done since, trying to argue certain arrangements will have certain consequences, and those are consequences that most people like or dislike, and that's an argument for or against those arrangements, and simply pushing aside the whole question of what consequences should we like. Is coercion inherently immoral? And I should say that, especially if you're a law professor, you realize that defining coercion gets harder and harder the more clearly you think about it. Issues of that general sort. So that was one of the two things I think I contributed to the libertarian debate. The other was a particular model of the legal system of an anarchist society. Because as far as I can tell, people thinking about this question before more or less accepted the idea that you use a legal philosopher to figure out what the law should be. And then when you figure out what the law should be, everybody agrees and that's the law. And that, again, does not strike me as a very plausible picture of what happens or what should happen. And it's not clear to me if that happens, you'll get libertarian law. And what I tried to do instead was to describe a plausible account of a market-generated legal system, of a system where, rather than some philosopher deciding what the law should be, an entrepreneur says, I am going to set up a court which offers to settle disputes between people, and I'm going to write a law code for that court, and I'm going to try to write the law code that my customers will want to agree in advance to be under. And if I get it wrong, one of my competitors, I'll have lots of competitors, will write a somewhat different law code, and people will discover that agreeing to be under that law code is more attractive than under my law code, and I'll lose business, and you will end up with a market-generated legal system. And Machinery of Freedom is available for free download from my website for any of you so unfortunate as not to have read it. And in that, I spend part three of the book, the last part of the original edition, the next to last of the current edition, sketching out the institutions in which such a system would work. And there's a second step to the argument, because what economics does not automatically tell us the market will give us libertarianism. What economics tells us is the market will tend to give us what economists refer to as an efficient outcome, which, roughly speaking, is the outcome that comes closest to giving everybody what he wants. And filling in that brief statement takes a chapter or so, and I'm not going to try to do it here. Because you obviously run into the problem of how do I decide whether something that gives you a little more of what you want and him a little less is an improvement or not. And I'm going to pass out, if you're curious, look up economic efficiency in one of the books of mine that's on my website, because there are several of them, and you can find my explanation of how economists use the term. But if you think of it sort of the first approximation as something like what utilitarians want, is maximizing total human happiness. And it's not exactly that, but it's sort of in that direction. And the missing step in the argument, which I tried to fill in, is that I believe that libertarian law comes at least reasonably close to having that characteristic. That I think most libertarians believe, and I believe, that on the whole, people will end up happier, coming closer to achieving the things they want in a society where they're free to control their own lives than in a society where they've got lots of control over each other and not so much control over themselves. If that's right, then if I can persuade people that my market for law will generate economically efficient law, it follows that it will generate something reasonably close to libertarian law. And we don't have to persuade everybody in the country to be a libertarian first. So that I would argue that if you have market-generated law, you will get libertarian law without the customers being libertarians, just as when you have automobiles designed on the market, you get well-engineered automobiles, even though very few of the customers are engineers. That you don't have to know the inside of it, as it were. You only have to know what results you want. And that, on the whole, libertarian law is going to give more attractive results. So that, I think, was my second major contribution to the argument. It's sort of a several-step argument, but showing how you could have market-generated law, showing why that market-generated law would at least tend to be economically efficient, and then giving at least a plausibility argument for why that economically efficient law would be roughly libertarian. And it's certainly not a rigorous proof. Again, as I say in Machinery of Freedom, I could imagine a society where the prejudice against heroin use was so strong that a market-generated law included my right to have you punished for using heroin, because practically all the customers want that, and the market gives customers what they want. But of course, in that population, government-generated law will also make heroin illegal, so it's no worse. And in a lot of cases where the feeling is less strong, I think market-generated law would surely have marijuana legal in our current population and very likely a fair number of other things. So those, I think, are what I saw as my contributions. Let me now say a bit about things that I have learned since and would want to add. And I will start where I just ended, with market-generated law. Because I have, in fact, a chapter in someone else's book called, I think, For and Against the State, in which I try to go to engage in a more detailed economic analysis of the market for law in my hypothetical society. That I sort of have a brief verbal sketch of the argument in Machinery, but I thought about it more. And it's interesting in two ways. First, while there are reasons to expect it to generate something like efficient law, they aren't really the same reasons that make us expect the market for automobiles or wheat to generate efficient outcomes. And the reason is that if you think about it sufficiently carefully, you realize that what looks like a competitive market is actually a few hundred million bilateral monopolies. Let me see if I can explain that a little, especially for any economist types in the audience, for everybody else as well. The market I'm thinking about is what I think of as the market for legal assent. that in order to have a functioning legal system, there's got to be some set of legal rules that apply between me and him, between me and her, between me and her. It don't have to be the same for every pair, but there have to be some way of reaching an agreement on what the legal rules for a controversy between any two people will be. And in machinery, I sketch sort of a plausible set of institutions for providing that. But I want to step back and do the equivalent of the sort of Robinson Crusoe part of an economic textbook, where instead of thinking of it in terms of an evolved system of division of labor and firms and that, just imagine individuals dealing with individuals. All right? And from that standpoint, what I need is to have a contract with everybody else I might interact with, agreeing on what court will settle disputes between us. And you might say, well, that looks like a competitive market. Look, there are 300 million people out there to deal with. But it isn't true, because if I can't buy grain from him, I can buy identical grain from her. But he can only sell his legal assent. He can't sell her legal assent. So you are going to have a mechanism of what is, in effect, what economists call a bilateral monopoly bargain. That is, a deal where two people have to agree on something to coordinate, like any just two-person selling situation. And you're going to have intermediaries to make it easier. You don't really have to negotiate with 300 million people. But you do have to, in some way, get legal assent with all of those people. And then I argue in that chapter that the mechanisms that drive you towards efficiency are more nearly the kind of arguments that Ronald Coase made about efficiency coming out of bargaining, out of transactions between people, than they are the classical perfect competition kind of economics. And I also show in that chapter that although it will tend towards efficiency, there are certain predictable ways in which it won't generate efficient law. And the clearest of these, the easiest to explain at least, has to do with the economic idea of externalities. That if I am taking an action where I get some of the benefit and bear some of the costs, but some of the costs or some of the benefits are given to third parties I'm not dealing with, I'm going to ignore those. And if there is an action which produces $100 of benefits for $80 of cost, but I only get $60 of benefit, I won't take it. All right? Now imagine that I'm bargaining, I or my rights enforcement agency on my behalf is bargaining over the legal rule between me and you. If our agreement has significant effects on other people, we will tend to ignore those. And the clearest example here is intellectual property. Because when he agrees to respect my copyrights, one result is that he pays me money that I receive. That's a wash. A second result is that we've got some transactional costs collecting that money. That's a net loss. But a third result is that I produce more intellectual property. That's a net gain. All right? If intellectual property law is useful, and that's a disputed point, but you can at least argue that some form of copyright or patent is useful as a way of giving people an incentive to write books and make songs and things. If it's useful, it's because the total gains are larger than the total losses. But we're bargaining over all of the costs and only part of the gains, because a whole lot of the gain from my producing intellectual property goes to all you people who haven't gotten into the bargain. And I will therefore, my agents will underestimate the value of intellectual property protection in setting up the bargain. And we might end up in a world without copyright, even if it were the case that a world with copyright would be better. And that's one example. And you think of other examples, environmental laws, that another place where the same issues arise, where the market for law will do an imperfect job of generating the law that most maximizes human happiness. And so that's, I think, a point. I think one has a sort of a moral obligation, if you're putting out ideas, to explain what's wrong with them as well as what's right with them. Part of what I don't like about the kind of talks and things like this, which are basically preaching to the converted, is that they don't try to do that. They're all about why we're right and not why some of our things are wrong or dangerous or might be wrong, or some of our arguments have problems, all of that stuff that you really have to think through if you want to take seriously your own beliefs. So that's one of the things that I was planning to add, is a rewrite of that chapter. Second is another question, maybe a more profound question, I guess. And that is that I sketch in Machinery of Freedom an answer to the question, what is a government? And if you're going to call yourself an anarchist, this is a very important question. Because after you set up your private institutions for protecting rights, somebody will reply to you, you're not really an anarchist at all, you just want a different structure of government. And so then the question is, what are the defining characteristics of government such that I can say that my private rights enforcement agency is not a government and the U.S. government is? And what I said in Machinery was that government was an agency of legitimized coercion. And I then explained that I was using both of those words in special senses. That what I meant by coercion was not really a moral philosophy category, but rather a description of the views of people in a particular society. So what I mean by coercion is, in a particular society, the kinds of things that people think of as wrong for one person to do to another. And whether their moral views are right or wrong, for my purposes, is irrelevant. And what I mean by legitimized is not that people regard it as morally legitimate, though they might, but that they don't respond to what they see as things people aren't allowed to do to each other, as you normally respond to people doing things to you that they're not allowed to do. So that if a private individual comes over here and grabs my digital recorder and runs out the door, I will be inclined to chase after him, to yell, to make a fuss, to go to a good deal of trouble, and I might well go to an amount of trouble that I recognize costs me more than the value of the recorder. All right? That there is a sort of a commitment strategy that we all have that underlies, I would argue, all functioning societies, which is, here are certain lines you shouldn't cross, and I'm willing to fight pretty hard to defend those lines. And I didn't go into enough detail of machinery because I hadn't thought it out carefully enough, though I had some of those ideas then. But the basic idea is that legitimized coercion means that it is a organization against which pretty much everybody has dropped that normal commitment strategy, is not going to respond in the kinds of ways that we're used to responding to ordinary individual rights violations. And that, therefore, what's special about a government is that it can do the sorts of things that we normally regard as rights violations, regard as things people can't do to each other. Well, that's not by definition by itself, because, of course, the private burglar does that too. But that when it does this, the normal response is to accept it, to take it for granted, maybe to say it's good, maybe bad, you may not believe it's morally legitimate, but you don't respond with the kind of sort of outraged, almost cost is no object fight that you do when private people do it. And I thought that was a useful definition of government, I still do. And that then, in my hypothetical, competitive, anarcho-capitalist society, there are certainly agencies using force against people who use force against their customers, but they're only doing the sorts of things private people could do. It's the difference between the agency and the private person is just that the agency is competent at doing it, being professionals in large. And I went into much more detail on this set of ideas in an article that's on my webpage, which is called A Positive Account of Property Rights. And it isn't really about property rights. It had that title only because it was written for a conference on property rights. It's really a positive account of rights. And what I'm arguing there is that there is a useful way of thinking about rights, which is neither moral nor legal. That we usually think of, when you say you have a right to something, we usually either intend that as a moral claim, to say somebody is acting wrongly if he stops you from that, or as a legal claim that the law says they can't do that. And I want to claim that there is a positive account, a description of a right as a pattern of behavior rather than as either a moral claim or a legal claim. And that goes back to what I was just saying, that each of us has... We are routinely in situations... Let me go back to bilateral monopolies for a moment. I have an apple that's worth 10 cents to me and a dollar to you. And you would be willing to pay any price up to a dollar, and I'd like to sell it to you for 99 cents. I'd be willing to accept any price above 10 cents, and you'd like to buy it for 11 cents. There's a big bargaining range. We are routinely in situations of that sort with regard not just to buying and selling stuff, but to the threat to do bad things to other people, to not cooperate with them, and so forth. And part of the way we deal with that is by having a set of what Thomas Schelling originally the ideas of what are sometimes called Schelling points of jointly recognized bargaining outcomes, like splitting something 50-50 would be an example, where each of us has managed to commit himself to saying, I shouldn't accept less than that, but it's all right not to insist on more than that, and therefore rather than have the bargaining break down, that's where we'll settle. And the example that I sketch out in my article is to imagine that you're in a suburban community which doesn't have very good law enforcement or courts, and one day your neighbor comes to you and says, you know, I've decided to save the trouble of taking stuff to the garbage dump. I'm just going to dump all my garbage on your lawn. And you say, well, I don't really like that idea. He says, well, yeah, I didn't expect you to like that idea, but you know and I know that trying to get the county to do anything about it is going to be much more hassle than it's worth. Be less trouble if you just pick up my garbage and dump it yourself than to try to actually get them to stop me. But I've got a deal to offer you. Pay me $10 a month and I won't. All right? And the question is, even if you believe that trying to do something about dumping the garbage on the lawn is going to cost you more than $10 a month, you still turn down his offer. And you've sort of got this vague intuition, if he can push me there, he can push me a little farther and a little farther and a little farther. And what the property right is the jointly perceived line, which says, my not extorting from you and you're not extorting from me, is the place where we can stop the bargain without it sliding further. Right? And so I think it is useful. The question I really start the article with is the question of, in what sense are we ever out of a Hobbesian order? Right, Thomas Hobbes described a world without government where everybody was everybody's enemy. And it wasn't really safe to sleep at night because somebody would kill you. And he thought you got out of that by having a sovereign, by having a king. Putting that aside, the intriguing question is, how do you get out of it? Because you can say, well, we've got laws and police, sure, but the police could all kill you too. Putting a uniform on somebody doesn't constrain what he does. What gives the pattern? Why is this an orderly society where people can sleep safely at night, where mostly their property is protected except against the government, and so on? And my answer is an elaborate set of mutually perceived commitment strategies, which underlies all of the formal order. And that, I want to argue, is the positive nature of rights. That in that sense, I have a right to something because not only will I fight to keep it, but the people who might take it know I'll fight to keep it. Both of us know I'll fight, not infinitely hard, but unreasonably hard to keep it. And usually that means it's not worth their trouble to try to steal it. All right? And as long as our perceptions are consistent, you can maintain a reasonably peaceful society on that basis. And I, in fact, suggest in that essay that one reason you tend to get violence on the interface between different cultures is because the people in different cultures may, in fact, have different perceptions of where those lines are drawn. And so from my standpoint, you're trying to extort me, and from your standpoint, I'm turning down a perfectly reasonable offer by you. Anyway, so I want to add that to the book because I think it fills out ideas that I understood intuitively but hadn't thought through carefully enough at that time. Third thing is I have a chapter towards the end of part three on national defense. And my basic conclusion is we might not be able to do it. That national defense runs you into what economists call the public good problem, that if we defend the country, everybody inside the country gets defended whether they pay for it or not. How do you get voluntary payment? And I sketch a number of imperfect ways in which you might do it, and I thought more about that. Now, partly it's an easier problem than it was, because Al-Qaeda has a whole lot fewer resources than the USSR did. And the fewer the resources of your potential aggressors, the less the resource cost of defending, and therefore the easier it is to use some sort of voluntary mechanism, charity, volunteers, and such to do it. But I thought in a little bit more detail about how you might do it and been inspired by a number of real-world phenomena I've observed, including the open-source software movement and historical reenactment. People like Civil War and Society for Creative Anachronism, and also with a slight tangent from that, paintball. And the kind of system that I've imagined, and I don't know if it would work or not, but I think it's at least possible. I'm also inspired by a rather odd Kipling story called The Army of a Dream. I can talk about that if people are interested a little later. But the kind of thing I'm imagining is that you have a small cadre of professional military people who are paid by charity, that basically donating to that because you believe that this is a wonderful society, you want to protect it from the statists raping beyond your borders up in Canada, that's enough to pay, 10,000 professionals in a society of hundreds of millions of people. You then have a whole bunch of volunteer militias. And the volunteer militias are doing it for some combination of patriotism and fun. And the fun are the same kind of people who would be doing Civil War reenactments or paintball, but it's sort of more exciting when it's real. Because, of course, you're the only effect you're fighting, right? I mean, that's only the emergency. What you're spending most of your time doing is games. What you're spending most of your time doing is competing against other such militia units in some equivalent of paintball maneuvers. You could think of a whole lot of different things. So you would have a whole bunch of semi-trained, as it were, soldiers. People who on their weekends, instead of going out to a medieval tournament or to reenact the Battle of Gettysburg, go out to do some sort of military training as a form of entertainment, bonding activity, etc., etc. They are subsidized, perhaps, by firms which want good PR, so that Apple Computer agrees that those of its employees that want to make up a platoon or a regiment or something of volunteers, they get to fly the Apple flag on April 15th when we celebrate our Independence Day. They, you know, in various ways get good publicity, and then the small cadre of professionals are the ones who are setting up some of the higher level competitions and games and trying to make sure everybody uses the same caliber bullets and doing a bunch of other things to coordinate. And that seems to me a not wholly unreasonable way in which you can defend without a state, as long as you have a society where people are reasonably happy with their own culture, and as long as you don't have really powerful, really formidable enemies to defend against. The Kipling story, by the way, I'll tell you a little about it. It's a neat and weird story. And it's basically his fantasy of an England where military games have replaced cricket and football as what people do. And he's come back to England. I don't think he ever says from where. And he's being shown around by somebody he knows who's a professional soldier who is, I think, functioning at this point as a referee or something in a game between two public schools. But the game is a military maneuver kind of game. And the result is that, sort of like Switzerland, in his fantasy, you've got an England where practically all adult males are trained soldiers at essentially no cost, because they've done this as sport and fun. And at the very end of the story, after it's all been explained, Kipling notices the bullet hole in the forehead of the friend who's been describing it and remembers this was a friend who was killed in the Boer War. And it sort of then dissolves, and it was a dream, and he's waking up. But I thought it was a really intriguing idea from a very bright and interesting guy. I'm a Kipling fan in many ways, of how you could imagine using things other than the normal mechanisms, using sort of non-market social mechanisms to motivate people to put in a lot of time and energy. And I've seen it done. I mean, I've been active in Society of Creative Anachronism for a long time. People put enormous amounts of energy and a fair amount of money and time into doing things. Every summer I spend a week at an encampment of about 12,000 people with medieval, a lot of them have medieval tents. They teach about 1,000 classes during the course of the week or so. And it's being done with volunteer labor for the fun of it, basically. And so I thought of, I'm running out of time.
They need to groom it too.
I'm sorry. All right, fine. All right. The last subject I was going to talk about is something that will get covered some in my Future Imperfect talk tomorrow. It is tomorrow, not today, by the way. They've been juggling schedules back and forth. So yes. Let's take questions now.
Well, we have to be out of the room by 2 o'clock.
At what time is it now?
Which is like 1:57.
All right. 3 minutes worth of questions, then we can then talk in the hall. Yes.
First of all, 1979, reading The Machinery of Freedom is what made me an anarchist. So. And every time I talk about libertarianism, I worry about your position on IP because I think you'll sue me for plagiarism. One of the most interesting.
When you are young, you're afraid people will steal your ideas. When you're old, you're afraid they won't.
The worst danger an author is not piracy and obscurity.
Yep.
Yeah.
What are the conditions you think are necessary for anarchy to work?
Oh, that's a question that we can't answer.
For it to be stable, you need that the rights enforcement agencies have economies of scale that don't go far enough to give you a very small number of agencies in a society, because if there are, they may get together and become a government. That's the clearest requirement that I can see, and the additional complication is you need an equilibrium in which violence between agencies is uncommon, because there are probably economies of scale in mutual violence, but not in the ordinary business of the agency.
Okay. We have to take it outside because they need the room.
Fine.
Sorry. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.